We've asked political junkie Ken Rudin to stay with us to talk about some other political news. And I guess, Ken, we have to begin with that failure to override the president's veto in the House of Representatives. And by the way, if you have questions for Ken Rudin, our political junkie, about the veto override effort and what happens now after the veto, we're also going to be talking about other events in politics this week. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. So this failure to override, of course, is no surprise.
Everything went according to plan. We knew that the House would pass the bill. We knew that President Bush would threaten to veto it, and he did veto it. We knew that the House would vote to override, and they would not have the two-thirds enough to override the veto. And now we're back to square one. What do we do now, given the fact that the funding for the troops runs out, eventually runs out? Do the Democrats insist on not backing down from having timetable language in the legislation and risk another veto? Or do, as some others say, look, maybe just have a fund the bill, fund it. Let's see if the surge works. Fund the war until September 30th and then revisit it then.
Mm-hmm. And will there be a veto override attempt in the Senate after it's failed in the House?
Well, I think they just want to go through the motions. I think they want to put both parties want to have the other party on record. But as Steny Hoyer said today, that it looks like that the House will pass another bill, perhaps without the language, we're not sure yet, within 2 weeks, and it'll be on the president's desk by Memorial Day to sign. My guess is that they don't, even though the left wing of the party does want to have that language. They feel that the November 2006 elections were a part of that, was a referendum on getting U.S. troops out. But I think there's a feeling in that they will just pass this perhaps till September 30th, fund it till September 30th, and then revisit it. If there's no evidence that the surge is working, the policy is working, then perhaps even some Republicans who have stayed with the Republican, with the president on this vote may be not so loyal to the president come September 30th.
There are those, as you've noted, and they include the Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards, who say the president vetoed it, just send him the same bill again, and if he wants to veto it, he's the one cutting off the funding for the troops.
Right, but there are some people, Carl Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, who's hardly a left-winger, says, or I should say hardly a right-winger.
There you go.
Says that look, every now and then reality has to step in here, and we should just get it done and then deal with the next one down the line. But it is interesting how the presidential candidates have to deal with this, because some people say that Hillary Clinton is looking beyond a Democratic electorate, looking towards a general election strategy. And if that's the case, we saw in the debate that she was, boning up on her foreign policy strengths. Perhaps she just says she'll say the same thing, too, that maybe we just send back a cleaner bill, something, yes, that the president wants, but by the next go around, he doesn't get his way.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Doug in Kingston, Missouri. Bush has received much publicity for his use of the signing statement, allowing him to pick and choose what he accepts in a bill. Why can't he do the same to the Iraq funding bill?
Well, again, it's sort of like, when President Bush says he's going to do something, at least we saw it before with stem cell research, the veto he
has. That's the only other veto he's cast.
Right, and
he
said this is completely unacceptable. There's no way that what the politicians have to say will outweigh what the military commanders on the field said. That's what President Bush says. And so from the beginning, he said he was not going to back down. He was going to veto it, and that's what he did yesterday.
Now, how much of a bind does this put, particularly in the Senate, some of the more moderate Republicans?
Well, that's a very good point also, because you have a handful of them up for re-election in 2008. 21 of the 33 senators up are Republicans. And you have people like John Sununu in New Hampshire, Norm Coleman in Minnesota, Gordon Smith of Oregon, Susan Collins in Maine. These people are really not gung-ho on the war. They've really soured on the war. And voters back home are going to be watching them very closely to see how they vote on this as well.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Jason. Jason with us from San Antonio.
Hey, good afternoon. I got a question about why the president vetoed this bill, because the timetables for withdrawal were non-binding in every report I heard, and I don't understand why he couldn't have just signed it and let it move on and then proceeded at his wish.
That was out of the conference committee, where the House version of the bill, which was a little more specific, was melded with the Senate version of the bill, which was, as Jason says, non-binding. There was no specific time frames for this.
Well, but except what the Congress did pass, what the led by the Democratic majorities, that the beginning of the troop withdrawals would begin this year, October 1st, and then gradually over the next year. Yes, he could have ignored it. He could have probably fudged it in some way, but I think the president really felt very strongly. He wanted to make a statement. I think he feels that, unlike the war, which is very unpopular with the American people, he has a case to make about the funding, whether the Democrats are being obstructionist or cut and runners, whatever he wants to call it. But I think he feels that he has a case, if only in the short run, a case to make before the American people. Mm-hmm. The longer this goes on, I think the advantage goes to the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Jason, thanks.
Well, thank you, sir. Can I have one quick comment?
Sure.
Thank you. Well, I know that the president made the comment that the lawmakers are trying to legislate to the military leaders on the ground, but the military leaders on the ground aren't leading the show. The president is. And so he's setting the policy, and then they're doing their best to implement that policy. And I think that the lawmakers have every right to express their opinion as well.
All right. Thanks very much, Jason. Let's go now to this will be John. John with us from Independence in Missouri.
Hi.
Hi.
Mine's related to the last caller. The Senate and the House seem to be spending a lot of time passing non-binding resolutions, and I'm just wondering what the point is to passing these resolutions if it's just a suggestion. Is it just people making political statements, or is it just, what's the point? I guess that's my question, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, John, thanks.
Well, it's either political statements or cowardice. We've heard Democratic candidates like Chris Dodd, John Edwards, and certainly Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel saying this is nonsense. If we are a Democratic majority, the people elected us to do something, not to pass non-binding resolutions. Stick to it, put a date there, and a date certain, and get out. And I think there's a lot of disunity in the Democratic Party. You'll see it in the members of Congress. You'll see it among the presidential candidates. But there are a lot who feel that, if the president's going to stand up for what he believes in, why don't we stand up on what we believe in? And that would be a date certain.
Mm-hmm. What is the time frame here? I mean, the president ticked off in his speech after he announced the veto last night. Within this number of weeks, we start losing funding and we have to switch funds from other accounts. We have to stop repairing vehicles and that sort of thing. And also, there's a congressional timetable, too. There's a Memorial Day recess coming.
There is. And that's why when Steny Hoyer said that it'll be on the president's desk before then. Look, ultimately, the troops will never be in danger of not being financed. I mean, there's some ways of playing around with money that the president will always make sure that the money goes to them. I think a lot of it is politics. A lot of it is rhetoric. But ultimately, it'll be on the president's desk by Memorial Day.
All right. Let's move on to another issue. A congressional task force has voted to investigate a disputed election in Florida's 13th congressional district. Disputed election in Florida. Who could have guessed? Tell us more about it.
And let me guess. I think the district was once held by Catherine Harris.
Woo.
This is the 13th district in Florida that Catherine Harris gave up to run for the Senate last year. It was a very, very close race. Officially, Vern Buchanan, the Republican, was declared the winner by 369 votes against a Democrat, Christine Jennings. And then upon further investigation, apparently some 10,000 votes were never counted by these automatic machines. Democrats said this is a conspiracy. It was stolen from us. There should be, at the minimum, a do-over. The Republicans said that's nonsensical. Ultimately, what it looks like happened is that the way the ballot, I'm not making excuses for anybody, but it looks like the way the ballot was designed, that it looks like the House race was part of the Senate contest, and then people just didn't see the votes. Some 10,000 people did not cast votes in the congressional race. They voted for Senate, they voted for governor, but not the House race. Democrats said these people were disenfranchised. There should be a new election. The House Administration Committee voted 2-1, two Democrats to one Republican.
Uh-huh.
Voted today 2-1 to continue the investigation. It's stuck in the courts in Florida. Nothing is getting done there, and they do something about it. If this is really a stretch here, but if the Democratic Congress votes to override the sanctioning of this vote, and if the election is declared, the seat is declared vacant, you're going to have such an uproar, such anger coming out from both sides in the House that it'll make the 2000 election look like a kid's playing in a sandbox. It's the emotions are very raw now between the parties. We see it in Iraq. We see it in the and basically every issue. And if the Republicans get this election taken away from them, as some Republicans fear could happen, you'll really see all hell break loose.
Mm-hmm. So is there likely to be a recount? Is there likely to be a second election? What's going to happen?
My gut tells me that what it will say that things went wrong, that things should have been taken, should have been clearer, that the ballot, and we've heard this before, the ballot should have been better designed. But ultimately, I think that they're not going to reverse it. Although there is some precedent in 1984 in Indiana, there was a victory, a very close race, where the Republican Secretary of State and the Republican apparatus in Indiana gave the Republicans the victory. The Democratic House voted to unseat that and give it to the Democrats. And again, as we say, all hell broke loose. And that was one of the reasons cited by the Republicans when they were elected to the majority in 1994, that it was an abuse of power. The Democrats were abusing their power. And we'll see what happens here.
Political junkie Ken Rudin, who writes a column by that name on our website. You can read it at npr.org. And we'll take more of your calls when we come back. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I do also have to thank our callers, bloggers, and emailers for reminding me that I mistakenly omitted a word in our promo about tomorrow's show about Turkey, which is, of course, the sole secular democracy in the Muslim Middle East. There is another one nearby, which I neglected to say that, but thank you for pointing that out. That's tomorrow's show on Talk of the Nation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email we have from Vince in Savannah, Georgia. President Bush made three recess appointments while Congress was adjourned for the Easter break. Given that such appointments are intended to allow vacancies to be filled rather than wait for an extended period for Congress to reconvene, President Bush's appointment of individuals who would never have gotten congressional approval seems to be a clear abuse of power. Why does no one challenge the legality of these backdoor appointments?
Well, I mean, the president has the absolute right to do that. We saw that with Bolton at the UN. It was a recess appointment, knowing that the Senate would never
The committee. He probably would have gotten approved in the Senate.
That's true, but the committee wouldn't exactly right. But look, the Democrats hoot and holler, and both parties have done this. Is it an abuse of power? No, because it's. They have the power to do it. Does it make for good relations between the two parties, between the two branches of government? Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is, I hit the wrong button. John. John's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. Listen, I wanted to make a comment about the speaker's comments about non-binding resolutions that are being passed. I just don't think it's right to categorize these things as somehow mysterious. These are clearly consensus-building, kinds of measures that are being taken. It's awfully hard to build a consensus where there's so much political fear about the fallout from any measures that are undertaken about the war. So I think there are probably lots of viewers like me who feel that these are consensus-building measures, and they are important for that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
The caller is absolutely right, but there's also a constituency in the Democratic Party which is angry, which wants U.S. troops out yesterday, and they feel that non-binding language is just a continuation of the same.
Well, I don't know. I'm the father of a serving Marine who just returned from Iraq, and I'm willing to take any measures that will get us out of there.
Thanks very much for the call, John.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. What's going to happen also, there were a lot of spending measures, which some would describe as pork, in this Iraq war funding bill designed to attract support or make it difficult for people to oppose this legislation, Katrina relief money, that sort of thing. Is that going to survive, do you think?
Well, perhaps, although, when Steny Hoyer said that they're going to send this back to the president, perhaps that money will stay there. They're talking about adding a minimum wage language to it as well. So the Democrats obviously need to get something out of it to go home to their constituents and say, look, this is the best we got. And so I would think that the Katrina stuff, which is really not pork, I mean, there's two separate things here.
Mm-hmm.
There is pork, and there's also must needed legislation to finance the ravaged areas in the Gulf Coast. But perhaps Katrina money and perhaps a language on minimum wage will remain intact in the next go around.
Mm-hmm. Let's get Barbara on the line. Barbara with us from Paradise, California.
Yes, hello there.
Hi.
I've been very upset about nobody discussing public financing for our elections. I think that so much could be saved by we could discuss, and it could be a really discussion on public financing.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly, is this anywhere in Congress? Is anybody discussing this, Ken Rudin?
Well, look at the advocates of public finance. I mean, John McCain was the author of the McCain-Feingold bill that called for public, you know, financing of campaigns. Hillary Clinton has long been a public an advocate of public funding, and yet because it's so, I'm not making excuses, but because it's so expensive, because the other guy is spending so much more money, both McCain, both Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama have all eschewed public funds, and they're going to raise and spend as much money as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ugly cycle, but it's ugly,
and I think it makes America look like we're buying our candidates, and we're buying our president, we're buying our senators. I think this looks bad to the rest of the world, and it certainly sounds bad to the voters. I mean, you know, you hear the announcer saying on radio, well, this candidate has 16 million, or this one has 14 million, instead of really saying what this candidate has accomplished or what they are really about. They talk about the money too much.
I hear this all the time, and it's very, very valid. Basically, we're talking about as if that was determining who would be the best candidate. Now, I will say that you cannot become, you would not be elected president if you're not raising enough money to be competitive. But for that to be the benchmark, I agree, that's a wrong way to judge candidates.
Barbara, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And Ken Rudin, we'll see you again next Wednesday for another edition of The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Neil.
And Ken Rudin is also NPR's political editor. Again, if you want to read his column, you can go to NPR.org. It's titled The Political Junkie. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
And I'll defend until the end the old red, white, and blue. I want to grow up to be a politician and take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land.